Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Parole is described as a kind of purgatory, a place between captivity and freedom. Newly released inmates have to follow a long set of rules and requirements, from who they can see to regular drug tests to seeking permission to go out of state. The hope is that during this time of regulated freedom, parolees will get their lives back on track. But there's a lot that can go wrong along the way. That's what reporter Emily Corwin explores in the new NHPR podcast called Supervision. Emily followed the story of one New Hampshire man, Josh Lavinitz, during his first weeks on parole. Through his experience, she uncovers the challenges of making parole work. You can find all four episodes of Supervision online at supervisionpodcast.org. Also, NHPR will be airing the entire series starting Monday, June 24th at 6:30 p.m. Today in The Exchange, another look at New Hampshire's parole system, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Emily Corwin joins us from Vermont today. She's an investigative reporter and editor at Vermont Public Radio. And as I said, former reporter for us here at NHPR, where she first covered Josh Lavinitz for the podcast Supervision. Emily, a big welcome back. Really nice to have you on our air.
Great to be here. Thank you.
With me in studio, Chief Seifu Ragasa. He's Chief Probation and Parole Officer at the Ossipee District Office for the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. He formerly worked as a corrections officer. He's on the board of Genesis Behavioral Health in Laconia. Chief Ragasa, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Tracy Scavarelli, Deputy Director with the New Hampshire Public Defender's Office. And Tracy, thank you also for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want everybody to describe the parole system as they see it. But Emily, you first, in your podcast, you kind of described it as purgatory. So give us a little more there, please.
Right. So, you know, parole, first of all, just basically is when you get a criminal sentence, you have a minimum and a maximum. And at your minimum, you can apply for parole. And if you are granted it, you can spend the duration of time left till you hit your maximum in the community. It's kind of like a reward for good behavior. It's also kind of a safety valve for overcrowding in prisons. And it allows a parole officer, and therefore the state, to keep tabs on people who are living in the community but getting out of prison.
So you might get a sentence, Emily, of 2 to 4 years. And after those 2 years, the minimum, as you said, you might be eligible to serve the rest of that sentence out in the community on parole.
Correct. Right. But the thing is, you know, when you're out in the community, I described it as purgatory because you aren't just like everybody else out in the community. You have to live by conditions that are significantly stricter than the laws by which, you know, you and I live. That can be very difficult. And you know, that supervision is something, you know, that parole officer has the ability to send you back to prison really at any time based on your behavior if you violated those parole conditions or if they think that you have. So that would be my description, but I'm keen to hear what other folks have to add.
Right. And those parole officers, as you discovered, Emily, have a lot of people they're keeping track of. So despite really good efforts, sometimes they can't keep tabs on everyone. Chief Ragasa, how would you describe parole to someone who really didn't understand what it meant?
Well, actually, there's always a misconception about when you talk about parole supervision and parole officers. And obviously, I wouldn't use the word such as keeping a tab. It's too negative for me. Ideally, our goal is the parole officers in the state and the supervisors. It's our goal to help offenders succeed in the community. We have the same goal as the offender. Offenders that are released to the community, they need to succeed and they need to max their time out. In times when offenders actually succeeded and have gone above and beyond, there were actually times where parole officer would write a letter or ask the parole board to discharge the person before they complete even their maximum sentence. We call it an early discharge, and that happens all the time.
So lots of incentives to do well on parole, Chief Ragasa.
Exactly, and basically, for the most part, I personally and our officers are encouraged to tell the offender, all right, here is the goal we are setting. My goal is the same as yours. I want you to succeed. If you do ABC without violating, if it is paying your restitution, completing the treatment recommended, or attending all the programs that's directed by the board, I will file an early discharge just to give them an incentive. The negative energy and the trouble comes when offenders start failing to meet their expectations and their requirements. So not keeping a tab, if anything, to help them reestablish in the community. That's our goal.
It's almost like you're a coach in one sense, a supervisor in one sense, but a coach in one sense.
It's just we have a very difficult task as it is. We are, in one hand, we help them in rehabilitation. And the other hand, we play dual roles. There is enforcement and rehabilitation. We do want offenders to succeed in the community. We do want offenders to complete the treatment they are supposed to complete and the obligation they have to fulfill, whatever the case may be. That is our goal. That's our officer's responsibility to help them there. Now, the trouble we are having is when it comes to enforcement. Now, we have to also maintain the public safety. When is the public safety at risk? In times where we sense there are risks, that there is a public safety at risk, now we have to wear that hat, which is considered enforcement.
Sure, if somebody is a repeat drunken driver and then they start drinking again, you don't want them on the roads. They might kill someone.
Exactly. And for example, a simple example would be a person who is released with a serious domestic violence charge. And one of the requirements will be on parole for this individual to complete a domestic violence counseling. If we are getting constant report from the domestic violence treatment provider telling us he's not reporting to domestic violence counseling, that's a red flag to us. So we have to address that. Now, the person might have done very well on supervision, and we've been working with this person. But once we learn this person is now not attending this treatment that is designed to help him reestablish in the community, we would have to start exercising and using the alternative sanction that are available to make sure and hope to bring him back to the domestic violence counseling.
And Tracy, from your perspective, again, as Deputy Director with the New Hampshire Public Defender's Office, what is parole? And if you could also explain for us, please, what the difference between probation and parole are.
Yes. So a person can be placed on probation by not having a jail sentence at all, or they can serve a lesser jail sentence in one of the county correctional facilities, and then they would be supervised within the community. Their supervision would be handled by the same exact person. So a probation officer is the same person as a parole officer. They simply have different persons that fall into different categories of supervision. A person on parole would be an individual who served at the New Hampshire State Prison.
I see.
And so their level of supervision is sometimes different, but generally speaking, they have the same rules while in the community, and they have the same individuals that they meet with. It's just different consequences for their behaviors. If you violate parole, you can be brought back to the prison immediately and then are required to go before the parole board to determine what will happen to you after. If you have a probation violation, it will be up to the discretion of the probation officer to determine whether that person should be held pending a hearing in front of a judge or whether they can remain in the community pending the resolution of their probation violation.
I see. So perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, Tracy, for minor crimes or first-time offenders, not that bad a crime, instead of saying, look, you need to go to jail, we'll put you on probation where you're still out in the community, you're still working, but you're being supervised.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes. So hopefully it's for a person who is able to stay in the community safely, versus a person who has to be incarcerated.
Well, and in terms of who gets parole and who doesn't, the person comes before the parole board. I want to play a little clip from Emily's podcast, Supervision. This is where Josh Lavinitz, again, that's the man she followed during his parole experience, has his hearing before the parole board. I found this really interesting because, as an outsider, this illustrated for me how this process sometimes plays out.
You're in for some pretty serious crimes. I mean, you assaulted your wife and your son. And
yes.
Looking at your record, there's a lot of assaults in your history. So how have you changed?
Well, I'm 39 years old. I lost everything because of my decision-making, my lack of decision-making.
Josh has good answers to all the questions. He's got job prospects. He knows where he's going to live and get treatment. And he says he understands now how his bad decisions are fueled by alcohol and depression.
All right, Mr. Lavinitz, we are going to grant you the privilege of parole. Your minimum is...
The board walks him through the conditions of his release. He'll get out in 2 months, in the spring.
Well, you know what you need to do.
Yes, ma'am.
Good luck.
Thank you, ma'am.
That's a clip from the new NHPR podcast called Supervision by Emily Corwin. It follows one man's experience with New Hampshire's parole system. It's by former NHPR reporter, now with Vermont Public Radio, Emily Corwin. Emily joins us this morning along with Chief Seifu Ragasa. He's Chief Probation and Parole Officer at the Ossipee District Office, along with Tracy Scavarelli, Deputy Director with the New Hampshire Public Defender's Office. And let's get your questions and comments in about how the system works, your personal experiences with it. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Emily, you experienced, as I just said, the parole issue, how it plays out here in New Hampshire, through this one man's story, Josh Lavinitz. Just briefly tell us who he was, Emily, and what his backstory is, because he's going to come up the whole hour today.
Okay, yeah. So Josh was from Rochester, New York, New Hampshire, excuse me. He was from Rochester, New Hampshire. He worked on a Christmas tree farm for many years there. He's a guy who loved to hike. He also struggled with alcohol use. And about 5 years ago, he was convicted of assaulting his then wife and her son, his stepson. And it was a pretty serious assault, and he got 2 years in prison. After I, you know, visited the parole board, I heard a whole ton of people get paroled, and I was taking notes there. Well, as you could sort of hear the hearings happening, I was jotting down notes. And Josh, among a handful of parolees, seemed like, you know, someone who was maybe earnest and interested, you know, sort of interested in his future enough to want to work with me to tell a story about parole. And so I wrote a letter to him after he got granted parole before he got out. And he wrote back to me. He was one of just two people who wrote back. And he said, you know, I really would love to work with you. He said, you know, I don't know. I've never been on parole. This is my first prison sentence. And I just have no idea, like, is my parole officer going to be, you know, waiting for me to hang myself? Or are they out there to really try to help me? I don't know. And so he and I started a relationship while he was still in prison, me calling and talking to him. And ultimately, I followed him for about 3 months after he got out of prison. But, you know, I'll say up front, you know, Josh had a pretty unexpected end to his parole and his life. He died unexpectedly about 3 months after he got out, and that is also part of the podcast.
How are those decisions made, Chief Ragasa? Clearly it's different for each person, but I just found it so interesting, that clip where you hear the woman saying, this is what you did, it's pretty bad, and he says, yes, but I really want to turn my life around, and she says, okay, we're going to give it to you. I'm really curious about that.
So these decisions are made by parole board. The parole board is an entity appointed by the governor, and actually the person who is currently in charge has been in charge for many, many years, and most of these people on the parole board are really well-respected community figures that have been selected to serve. Now, the person, once the person meets their requirement of current minimum parole date, they will be brought before the parole board, and the parole board will discuss and review the person history, the person's history, and they will also see the underlying offense, and they will see the contributing factor of whether or not if this person going to succeed in the community, was he given a prior parole, was he has he failed or she failed on parole. Now they oversee both New Hampshire State Prison for men and New Hampshire State Prison for women. So there are many factors they consider before they grant parole and they deny. The unfortunate fact is they see a lot of things that are not or that Emily probably couldn't see from that parole board table they were reviewing. Now,
documents and so forth?
The documents, for example, a criminal history, you know, the individual criminal history. They have to go through a list of criminal lists, criminal conviction that person has done. They have to see and review and ask questions. You know, why should we trust you to be safe in the community? Because they can't just grant parole to everyone that is applying for parole. They have to make sure that this person is he or she is going to succeed in the community. So it's a tough decision to make, and they have so many requirements that they have to follow to make sure they're not releasing someone who's going to be a public safety risk.
Sounds like a very hefty decision.
It's a very hefty decision, and especially in New Hampshire. These are volunteers. We're not talking about a full-time parole board members like in the state in Massachusetts where they are paid significant amount of money. These are volunteers that are serving almost to no salary, and these are a bunch of people who are doing good for the state. So they are doing this to make sure that offenders are given the opportunity to work establish a productive society member life. But in the meantime, they have to make the tough decision of saying no. And sometimes offenders go back, you know, again and again for parole hearing. So depending on who they are dealing with, in this specific incident, looks like the young man, this is his first time, but by looking at the facts, you know, that hearing could have gone two ways. He had a lengthy criminal history.
Yeah, this wasn't his first.
He has a lengthy criminal history, but what he was telling them was, you know, acceptable. He had said that I've had it enough and I'm ready to change my life. And I guess that was satisfactory for them to accept and grant him a parole.
Wow, Tracy, I don't envy the parole board. It's a hard decision to make, to sort of look at the documents, as Chief Ragasa said, look at the person in front of you. What's your sense of how the parole board in New Hampshire makes those decisions, and do you think they do a reasonable job at it?
Well, I think that they do have to look at all the documents that are prepared for them. They have to rely a lot on the staff that are within the New Hampshire State Prison system, because those are the individuals that work with the parolees on a day-to-day basis. So while the parole board is seeing the person at the parole hearing, they've not worked with them on a day-to-day in Josh's situation, last 2 years. So it really will be dependent on those individuals behind the walls that work with Josh to relay their opinions on how he did within the system. You have to meet a specific security level prior to even becoming eligible for parole.
What does that mean, Tracy?
That means you have to be at least C2 or below in order to meet eligibility. So you have to have been meeting acceptable requirements within the parole or within the prison system. You have to have been following the rules. You could not receive any disciplinary reports that are egregious. You would have to earn your good time. You would have to be participating in the classification requirements that they provided to you when you first entered into the system. So he would have had to work pretty hard to gain the even privilege to becoming a person eligible to go before the parole board.
So it's not easy to get on parole.
That's correct.
Do you agree with that, Chief Ragasa?
I agree with her that the person has to be C2, what we call a classification level 2. There are different classification system. And when the person walk into the prison, there is a classification system we have in the prison system. They classify that person, that individual, as a maximum classification, and then they will work their way down to medium supervision level. The person has to be on minimum supervision level in order for the parole board to consider this individual to grant or deny the parole. That is absolutely correct. Now, it is also the individual initiative. If the person came into prison with court-recommended treatment and the person came to the prison and say, oh, no, I'm not completing these programs. I don't think this person is a candidate to be classified as a C2 or a C1 classification level.
So it probably depends on that.
Depending on the individual interaction and activity.
All right. A lot more to talk about after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for The Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Life on Parole, a new NHPR podcast called Supervision, tells the story of one New Hampshire man whose experience shows why so many parolees struggle upon release. What questions or personal stories do you have with the parole system? Let us know. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And you can find the new podcast at supervisionpodcast.org. Also starting June 24th, NHPR will be airing the podcast starting at 6:30 in the evening. You can join us now with an email or a phone call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Emily Corwin, Chief Ragasa, Tracy Scavarelli, let's go to our listeners. Michael sends us an email. He says, can Emily cite examples of which restrictions and behavior modifications she feels are ineffectual in preventing reincarceration? Is there data that shows an absence of curfews or alcohol restrictions leads to fewer reincarcerations? Michael, thank you so much. And there's a lot embedded in that question, Emily. First of all, just remind us of what some of these restrictions are, because you talked about that early in the show.
Right. So some of the restrictions are, you know, failing to report to your parole officer. That's a requirement. And actually, I'm just going to list you the top three reasons people end up back in prison. This is from a recidivism report published by the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. So failure to report to a parole officer, that is the number one reason. And more than half of the parolees who go back to prison go back for that reason. The next is, I believe it's called Rule 3, and I believe it's failing to tell your parole officer where you're living or what your employment situation is. Or maybe perhaps it's, I'm looking at the report here, perhaps it's actually failing to have a good residence or employment. It's Rule 3. So the chief here can tell me exactly what that is. And then the third reason, though, cited is Rule 11. And Josh, you know, did not end up going back to prison, although if he had lived, he might have because of this rule. And that is using, selling, or being in the presence of controlled drugs or alcoholic beverages, using alcoholic beverages to excess. And that one, you know, is the one that really was the struggle for Josh. He had a problem with alcohol. Alcohol is something that is legal for adults to use in the community. His friends, you know, drank. His family drank. And I know I really believe that he truly intended and wanted to not drink when he was out of prison. And yet that was incredibly difficult for him. And so, you know, and I'm sure with people who are struggling with addiction to, you know, even more addictive substances like heroin, opiates, that's got to be, you know, a huge reason.
Well, and here's a question that I have for everybody. And clearly this man, Josh Lavinitz, struggled with depression, mental health issues, and substance abuse, that sort of, you know, co-occurring disorders, as people in the field call it. So to you first, I think, Chief Ragasa, is someone like this person required to seek substance abuse treatment? Does the state help them with that substance abuse treatment? Is it recommended? Just how does that play out?
Yeah, I definitely would get back to that question. Yes, to answer your question is yes, but at some point I'd like to address the rule number one and rule number three violation, especially which seem to be the higher rate. And it is true, and it is possible that failure to report to probation or parole is a serious offense, because what happens is rule number one deals failure to report to the probation parole officer at the time and place as directed. Rule number three is basically persons change residence without notifying the parole officer, which we consider to be very serious offenses. And this is why. When we direct an offender to report, now parole, we all know that, it is a privilege. But the person, we need to know the whereabout. We need to have the accountability of which offender is where and where they are residing. When the person failed to report, and I know that has increased significantly in conjunction with rule number three, I as a supervisor, when a parole officer comes to me and say, so-and-so have failed to report, we will send that officer, make sure you go to the last known address and verify if that person is still resides at that address. Now, the parole officer would go to that residence and say, I'm here to check on so-and-so. Most of the time, with those violations, almost 98% of time, the current residents of that place would advise us, no, he's moved out, he's gone last month, he's gone. So at that point, we have now a parolee whose whereabouts is unknown. So we have to notify the parole board and say, he's not reporting, we don't know his whereabouts. It is a public safety risk, and we would request a parole warrant for the person arrest. So we are very strict. We need to know when these offenders are changing their residence, and so that we can tell, yeah, we are supervising this person based on the classification, the risk assessment, or we also know this, where this person is complying to the parole direction. It is a condition of, and those are the two things that we don't encourage our offenders to fail to comply with.
Yeah, there's victim considerations when someone is not.
And that's where exactly I was hitting. If I have a domestic violence case and the person failed to report, I don't know his whereabouts, and I don't know where he's staying. Now I have to also ensure that the victim is aware of the situation and this person's whereabouts are unknown. And we have to protect victims from being re-victimized again. So it's became a public safety risk. And yes, most of our violation will be rule number one and rule number three.
What do you think about this, Tracy? The rules that people have to follow when they're on parole, and whether there are some that lead to reincarceration too quickly, or what do you think?
I think it's daunting to an individual who first is released back into the community after being in such a structured environment, such as the prison, where they're required to follow rules, they're required to do as told, and then they're released into the community. Most of them do not have family or friend supports, and therefore they do not have the monetary means to comply with some of the rules. Many of them are required to engage in counseling, mental health, get medical care, and they don't have the money to do so.
That's a question, and sorry to jump in, but that seems to be a huge issue with a lot of parolees, the mental health counseling, the substance abuse counseling. But if you don't have money or health insurance, does the state help you with that? Does the county help you with that?
They have sliding scales, and some of the offices have LADACs on staff. A LADAC is a licensed alcohol drug counselor. So some of them are able to receive the evaluations on site. However, the follow-up counseling that they're required to do would be out of pocket. Many providers do work off a sliding scale, so they'll have the individual file a financial affidavit and determine their ability to repay. But when you're first released in the community, they don't have jobs. Many don't have transportation. Many don't have licenses, so they have to even go through the process of trying to get relicensed by the state of New Hampshire, and they don't have the money to pay for reinstatement fees or the classes.
They may not have access to all those documents, too, that you have to provide when you get a driver's
Correct.
License.
Correct. So I would say that the biggest problem is that it's just a daunting amount of responsibility for a person who is not used to living that way in the community.
Chief Ragazzi, I can see yes. You want to jump in on this issue of, given how big an issue mental health and substance abuse seem to be for a lot of parolees, yes. What is provided?
So basically, some of, I would say now, most of our offices are currently providing a LADAC assessment, as Stacey stated. Now, that's a huge factor. Obviously, if the treatment is recommended, and this individual would have to go to a treatment provider, and there is a sliding scale fee where most treatment providers would work with these offenders, and there are also other state-initiated programs that could help the offender. It could be Medicaid. And so the options are out there. Also, at the halfway house level, right now, there are programs which are being implemented. Obviously, we have LIDA counselors that help this offender with transition. We had one individual recently. We had two. We added one more. We have now three who are assigned to basically help with the transition of these offenders joining into the community and helping them in, you know, but whether or not with the opioid crisis and providing them the Narcans and other treatment options and working with them. So it is a process, and the department is moving forward by adopting policies and treatments that are supposed to help reestablish these offenders in the community. And the perfect example would be the recent program they have started helping offenders how they can reestablish before they are released. And even the plan is to have these lead acts go to the community, to the district offices, and assist them in reestablishing a productive society member life.
I'm glad you mentioned halfway houses, Chief Ragasa, because Emily, Josh Lavinitz was in one of these shortly after he got out of prison, right? Seemed to be
this
a pretty
a
good
little
arrangement for him. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a little different. It's not a halfway house.
Okay.
I believe the halfway house system is prior to release. This was a county-run, county-funded transitional housing facility that's actually designed for people on probation, not parole. And Josh had managed to get access to it as a place to live right after he got out of prison. And it would have been great. It provided transportation to job interviews. It would have provided transportation to medical appointments, which might have been nice for him. Food, quite a few services, really. And it's in Stratford County in Dover, and it's a program run by Stratford County. Unfortunately, Josh was kicked out on his second day there. Because he was found drinking alcohol, is my understanding, although I've had a hard time confirming that. And so he never really got to take advantage of those resources.
And you mentioned in the podcast, Emily, you know, this is a pretty sweet deal for him.
It would have been. Yeah, absolutely.
He talks to you in the podcast right after this happened. Doesn't seem as fazed by it as maybe he should have been, given that he was getting housing, transportation, two meals a day. But here he is talking to you, Emily, just how happy he is to be out of prison, appreciating the simple pleasures of life. And like I said, when you talked to him, this was right after he'd gotten kicked out of that housing situation. Let's hear.
I love laundry. I love shopping. I love cooking. I love doing all the things, the little chores of everyday life.
Really?
I really appreciate it.
It's these little details that remind me how different Josh's life was on the inside. It's like getting kicked out of a group home pales in comparison to laundry and fresh produce.
Fruits. I love eating fruit. All of it. And in prison, they don't serve you fruit. They're so afraid of making alcohol that they will malnourish you.
Wow, so what do you do? How do you get fruit now? What's yours?
The grocery store, which is wonderful.
Again, that's from the new NHPR podcast called Supervision. The podcast is available now at supervisionpodcast.org. Also, we're going to air the show starting Monday the 24th from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Today in The Exchange, we're sort of pulling from some of the themes of this podcast, looking at life on parole through the experience of this one man that Emily Corwin followed. And we're hearing from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Trace, I wanted to ask you about something you said a moment ago. You said it's daunting for people when they come out of prison on parole. You can hear the joy in that clip. He's so happy to eat fruit. But what is so daunting?
A lot of people who are first released out of prison do not have a lot of family support or friends that are capable of providing them a safe environment to live and flourish in. Many of the people that they go back to have had difficulties themselves. That's how they found themselves in this cycle of crime, frankly, and incarceration. The rules require you not to associate with other individuals who have criminal records or who have convictions. Many of their family members or former friends have those, And while I appreciate the sentiment behind the rule, I think the application of it is sometimes difficult because those are the only people they have in their lives.
To live with.
To live with, to associate with, to try to find jobs through, to support them emotionally and physically. So it's really difficult for them to simply say, today is the day that you create an entirely new life without any real supports. You don't have any money when you first get out unless you have family or friends that are willing to loan you money. You don't have a job. You have a felony conviction now on your record, which makes it that much more challenging to get a job. You likely don't have transportation, which makes it that much more likely difficult to find a job, to get to a job, to arrive on time.
So we talked about the long list of rules that people have to follow. And, you know, all of you talked about the importance of some of them, getting counseling, staying away from victims, obviously not engaging in other crimes, staying in touch with your parole officer. So are you saying, Tracy, though, that this one particular rule, don't associate with any parolees, other parolees or probationers or other persons known to the parole board? These are some of the rules that I'm reading from. That one is problematic if you want people to set up housing and make connections.
I think in conjunction with many of the other rules, it creates some difficulties. And I agree and I understand the basis or the rationale behind the rule. And I know that you can go to your probation officer and get permission to have contact with particular individuals, but they have to do research and investigation into those individuals before they grant you permission. And that takes time.
And in the meantime, you might be on the street.
Correct.
Do you want to jump in, Chief Ragasa?
Yes. So the restriction was criminal companion. Most officers, we take no pleasure of telling an individual, you cannot hang out with so-and-so who you grew up with. Families, we take exception.
So under, there are exceptions.
At no time we would take a position of, you can't see your father, or you can't see your wife, you can't see your mother. No. The issue we have is, especially if they are requesting to associate with their co-defendant, the answer will be no. We're trying to prevent, our goal is to make sure that we're not setting them up for failure. So oftentimes we're more concerned about a criminal companion that would lead them, you know, that would tamper the rehabilitative measures. That would basically setting them up for failure. That we can't allow.
Can I jump in here, Laura?
So, yeah, hold on, Emily. Let Chief Ragasa finish and then go ahead. Yeah.
So for the most part, even for friends, if we see that, if an individual presents who he wants to hang out with and what is the purpose of it, if they are going to treatment, there are exceptions we can make, even though that's not immediate family member. But for the most part, we don't deny them access to, you know, reconnect with their family members and whatnot. So it's depending on the discretion used by the officer. But for the most part, even friends, if we see it appropriate, that would help them with the rehabilitation process. They're going to treatment or somewhere. I don't think any parole officer would deny that. Obviously, our goal is the same.
Parole officers have some discretion then, Chief Ragasa, you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about this idea of discretion because in the parole situation, you know, there's discretion up and down the criminal justice system. It's built in, and but in parole, there is just an extraordinary amount of discretion because these parole officers, you know, they have a relationship with the parolee, and the parole officer's, you know, belief system, their mood, their you know, bias or for or against parolee based on any number of things, you know, and their, like, you know, genuine, you know, sense of authenticity, what is an authentic statement, all of that can play in. And so, you know, I think it's you know, with Josh, I found this issue of, you know, what is a legitimate felon relationship for Josh versus a bad one to be very unclear. He could really only find work working in construction for a guy who had, you know, 33 cases against him in the courts, civil and criminal. Basically all of his employees had felony records. And when I talked to Josh's parole officer about this, he sort of waved it aside. He was like, oh, well, I mean, it's worth it for him to have a job. I don't know that Josh ever had a conversation with the parole officer about that. And, you know, Greg Morginis, the parole officer I spoke with, he admitted that, like, his very decision-making has changed dramatically over the 18 years. Now it's probably 20 years that he's been an officer. And, you know, he said that when he was younger, he did send people back to prison for, you know, what he would now consider, you know, unnecessary infractions. And now he has a lot more tolerance and willingness to give people a second chance. And I was just, you know, blown over by just the degree of discretion that's built into the system.
Chief Ragasa?
And obviously, Emily, a lot has changed in the past 18 years. Now the department has policies and protocol in place. Let's say 18 years ago, if a parole officer filed a parole request and violated someone for having a simple contact, now we have a review system where the probation officer, the probation parole officer, had to bring his warrant to the chief of the office, and the chief would inquire, what kind of alternative sentencing or sanction have you used before you request the warrant? So, yes, his opinion have changed over the past 18 years because we now have supervisors who closely monitor who's getting violated, why they are getting violated. More importantly, what kind of alternative sanction the person had used, the officer, the probation parole officer, had used prior to seeking a warrant or prior to arresting an offender. So I think that is the system that the department is blessing working perfectly.
Since you mentioned, Emily, Josh's parole officer, Greg Morginis, let's just hear a little bit from him. He's a very compelling figure in this podcast. Here he is describing how his outlook on people involved in crime has changed over his many years on the job.
Going in the field, especially, and seeing kids in horrible situations, it really kind of got to me. And over time, I've had grandparents and parents and the kids. I've had, you know, three generations of people on supervision. And, you know, I've had kids in here where they color and give them lollipops. And it's a day out to the probation officer instead of, you know, going to the dentist or the doctor. So it's normal for them. And, you know, when they're 18 and 25, it's going to be normal for them at that age and for their kids to be here. So it's a generational thing, and it's hard to watch that with really no ability to break that cycle.
Again, that's parole officer Greg Morginis talking in the new NHPR podcast, Supervision, which is about life on parole in the Granite State. We'll take more of your questions and comments after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Support NHPR today for a chance to win two $1,000 Southwest Airline gift cards. Good for flying out to visit friends in San Jose, California, or exploring rainforests near San Jose, Costa Rica. You'll be automatically entered into this incredible drawing to choose your own adventure when you support NHPR today at nhpr.org. Good luck.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the summer slide. How much learning do kids really lose over their long summer break? We'll find out tomorrow on The Exchange. Join us for that, live at 9. This hour, we're taking another look at New Hampshire's parole system, how it works, what success means, and why that can be so hard to achieve. And we've been hearing from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Emily Corwin. She's an investigative reporter and editor at Vermont Public Radio, former reporter for us here at NHPR, where she first covered Josh Lavinitz for the podcast Supervision, which explores this one man's experience on parole. Also with us in studio, Chief Seifu Ragasa, Chief Probation and Parole Officer at the Ossipee District Office for the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. He formerly worked as a corrections officer. He's on the board of Genesis Behavioral Health in Laconia. And Tracy Scavarelli is with us. She's Deputy Director of the New Hampshire Public Defender's Office. And all of you, we've been talking about the rules and regs that parolees have to follow, some of the challenges they face in following those rules and regs, including substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, housing, transportation, and so forth. Tracy, to you first, but I want to hear from everybody. What would make it better?
I think providing additional supports in the community would help individuals. We have a housing shortage in New Hampshire, which makes it very challenging for individuals to find safe housing. While they can certainly live with other individuals or try to find an apartment, they might not have the resources to do so, and it may not also be the safest place for them to go. Even the county correctional housing system that Emily referred to earlier, you're housing all individuals who are either on parole or probation together, meaning that they've all been convicted of crimes. You're not integrating them with normal society, so you're not interplacing them within normal neighborhoods so that they can learn good quality life skills from other examples in the community.
So housing's a big challenge, Tracy.
It's a huge challenge, and I think also receiving services such as counseling is a huge challenge. If you don't have Medicaid or transportation to get to the counseling, you're not able to really take advantage of those services, which many of them require.
And we did get an email from Scott who says expanded Medicaid has been one of the most important steps in the past decade for helping people stay out of prison and getting treatment. Thank you, Scott, for the email. Chief Ragasa, what do you think? What would make it better? What would make more parolees more successful?
Resources.
Just what Tracy said.
Yeah. Well, the resources provided to the Department of Correction in general. Oftentimes during budgetary crisis, when we have any issues, where is the department? The state goes, Department of Corrections. Now, we are expecting Department of Corrections sometimes to do some things that are humanly impossible. As I heard about the deceased in this case, and obviously he has so much anxiety before he even get to know the parole officer, okay? We used to have institutional probation parole officers that used to help offenders and prepare them before they go out to the community. We've lost those positions back in 2009 when they attacked the Department of Corrections budget. The unfortunate part is we don't hear about so many great things that are done within the Department of Correction. And unfortunately, we review correction and we discuss about issues in correction when bad incidents like this incident takes place. The men and women who are doing an outstanding job with the limited resources, they oftentimes they don't get the credit they deserve. The probation parole officers who have had more success rate than death, you don't hear much about them. So the word needs to get out there. And, I mean, the department, obviously, we welcome anyone that could come in and visit our office or visit the prison system. This is the best time to change Department of Correction. This is the best time to change community supervision. But let the stories also get some facts. Let's not only discuss about offenders when tragic incident takes place. What is that the parole officers do in this state? What is the caseload they carry?
What are the caseloads they carry?
Well, you know, in the state of Vermont, where Emily is, they have a statutory requirement. They supervise 45 offenders, 4-5. Well, in New Hampshire, we have doubled, if not tripled, that number. So our resources are limited, oftentimes with budgetary issues, and lawmakers cut the budget for this department, but yet we're expecting miracle to take place, given the resources that are very limited. I can tell you for sure, the recent two counselors at the halfway houses, that is also a new directive to bridge the gap so that offenders are integrating into the community, the transition is small. But most of the problem affecting offenders or incarcerated inmates, it is not the lack of effort from the department part or the lack of effort from the fine probation parole officer in this state. I'm actually proud to be serving with them, or the correctional officer who are doing a fantastic job. It is the lack of resources. We just can't create miracles with the very limited resources we have. And every time when we attack the prison budget, what we are doing is we are basically taking programs out. We are cutting programs from the programs we have limited. Unfortunately, the department cannot function without resources. And I think providing the resources necessary, and I understand it is a tough topic. Nobody wants to spend money on the prison industry. But I'll tell you what, it is it could probably in the longer term could help if we provide the resources. That could help with housing. That would help with transitional system. That would help with reestablishing their life in the community. That would give additional tools to the probation parole officer so they can manage their case effectively. Those are the resources that could change the offender's life or create a safer environment in the community.
Well, I want to ask about the caseload, so I'm glad you mentioned that. And Emily Chifragasa says in Vermont, where you now live, it's 45 per caseworker. How many parolees was Josh Lavinitz's parole officer, Greg Morgenis, in charge of?
Gosh, I can't remember the exact number. I want to say that he usually had a caseload of about 110, but at the time I talked to him, it was like 140.
That sounds about right. I listened to the podcast yesterday. Yeah. That's a lot of people to keep track of.
But you know, I think there's a whole lot of issues that go into this question of what would help. And I just wanted to bring up, you know, I was completely struck by the fact that none of Josh's friends or family, and he had very close, you know, he had very loving mother, very loving friends, who none of them visited him while he was in prison. And he was in prison just 2 hours from where they lived, which to them seemed like a lot of time, to me seemed like not very much. And the reasons they didn't visit him were that they were worried their cars wouldn't make it. They couldn't get time off of work. Josh's mom worked at, I think it was Walgreens, and I got the sense that she could, you know, maybe, you know, like on the day he was supposed to get out of prison, she took the day off of work to greet him. His paperwork had not gone through properly. He didn't get out that day. She could not take a day off a week later to greet him. And so, you know, these community ties get severed when somebody is in prison. And then they come back, and I think, you know, at a time when they need those relationships more than ever, they're back in the community without those the maintenance that relationships require over years. And I wanted to mention, you know, while you brought up Vermont, there are alternatives to, you know, the Department of Corrections providing the resources that people need. And I do think there's a reason. I do think, you know, after you've been incarcerated, there's a reason to believe that resources provided by the Department of Corrections or parole may not be as utilized or as welcome by inmates as resources that are coming from elsewhere. And there's a documentary that came out in Vermont about a program here that's run through Vermont's community justice centers. And it's a model where, you know, volunteers create groups into which recently incarcerated people, you know, can associate after leaving prison. And they provide, you know, the idea is that these volunteer groups create bonds of support and friendship and accountability. And they are not associated with the Department of Corrections.
So that's another model to look at.
And I think, you know, I think one can think creatively, although I certainly do not doubt that resources would make a huge difference.
Yeah, those caseloads sound pretty startling. Let's go to our listeners again. And John's calling in from Newmarket. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I just want to tell a quick story about a friend of mine who was spending time in Concord, and he was going to get paroled out and go live with his brother in a farm in Vermont. And his brother, it turned out, hadn't lived there long enough to have established residency. He'd only been living there about 5 months. So instead, he went to a halfway house in Manchester. And within about 2 weeks, the drug dealers he'd been working with before found him and basically said, you know, time to go back to work. And now he's serving a 15-year sentence for selling fentanyl. Mm. And it just seemed like the system, you know, I can only help but, you know, wonder what would have happened if he'd gone to live in this farm in the middle of Vermont versus getting stuck in Manchester, which is where he got arrested in the first place. It just seems completely like beating the cycles, just, you know, eating these people up.
Yeah, John, Tracy, that's something that you mentioned earlier. So go ahead. The housing issue is really, really important.
I also agree with him. There are restrictions on where you can live when you first are released. So the issue he's discussing is the out-of-state requirements or permissions that you need to receive from your parole officer. And the person who they're going to be living with have to be investigated again, like I mentioned earlier. And if he had only lived there for 5 months, that would not be sufficient for established residency, as the caller indicated. But I think that there has to be some leeway in those rules. I think that the rules serve a purpose, but there has to be discretion to allow individuals to live in a healthier environment. So in that situation, I definitely think that Vermont would have probably been a better suited rehabilitative measure than having him return to Manchester without family or resources.
Although I do wonder how his parole officer could keep track of him if he's in Vermont. The New Hampshire-based parole officer can't.
They could transfer probation or parole to out of state, and then he would be working with a Vermont parole officer so that they would still have a person supervising him in the community.
Chief Ragusa, real quick.
Yes. So one of the two things might have happened in this case without getting into it or not knowing what has happened. When an offender walks into the parole office and says, I would like to move to Vermont, we absolutely have no control of how Vermont will respond to it. There is an interstate compact agreement where we would file the interstate compact request. Vermont would conduct an investigation and say, it's acceptable, it's not acceptable.
So sometimes they say
No, most of the time the receiving state has a say about who they accept. The same thing with us. If someone wants to move in, our officers will investigate the residence and determine whether or not if it is a suitable residence to accept. So we don't really know what exactly happened in this case. But if there was a denied request, it would be from Vermont because there are reasons why they wouldn't allow that residence to be a transition place for this offender.
It sort of illustrates what Tracy said earlier, the importance of finding a safe place to live where you're not going to be so easily tempted to reoffend. John, I'm sorry to hear about your friend, and thank you for calling in. And, you know, hard to believe we've run out of time. Emily, I did want to ask you, what's the one aspect of this story that really stays with you from working for so long on this podcast?
It's really just understanding how vulnerable people are when they get out of prison. I did not understand or appreciate that before I started working on this podcast. And, you know, especially when you get out of prison, you have no money. You are reliant on this community around you to support you. And it's a community, like I mentioned, you may have had very little contact with over the last few years. And, you know, in the case of Josh, who passed away, you know, I was trying to understand his death, and I came to understand that 13%, I'm sorry, I shouldn't bring up a new statistic at this point, but so many parolees actually do go to the ER or pass away in the years following, initially following prison. And it's just that they're so vulnerable. There's something about incarceration that that makes you vulnerable. And so that was the big takeaway that I had.
Well, again, the podcast is available now at supervisionpodcast.org. Also, NHPR will air the show starting Monday, June 24th at 6:30 p.m. Emily, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Emily Corwin, investigative reporter and editor at Vermont Public Radio, former reporter for us here at NHPR. Chief Ragusa, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you for making the trip.
Thanks for having me.
Chief Seifu Ragusa, Chief Probation and Parole Officer at the Ossipee District Office for the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. And Tracy Scavarelli, it was really good to talk to you, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Tracy Scavarelli, Deputy Director with the New Hampshire Public Defender's Office. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.